Blog Talk Radio.
Masonic Effects. On this, the 22nd day of January 2017, the 22nd day of the year, it only gives us 343 days left. Ah, my goodness. And what are we going to cram pack into that amount of time? There's only 56 days of winter left. Things are moving along really quite nicely, I must say, and I think in true Masonic fashion, we've accomplished that. And I know that you're all making necessary preparations here across Canada for Groundhog Day, the 2nd of February. It's coming up next Thursday. So just be mindful of that week Thursday. Just be mindful of that. These things, these celebrations can take a lot out of a fellow. I think we have a startling occasion today a startling commentary today, and a challenge for all of us to think about how it is that we merge and blend and fold, how one aspect of Masonry folds into another. We have done yeoman's service as an order, contributing to charities, large and small, big C and small C. But the part that's most amazing about you fellows is that there is the what I refer to as the dark matter of Masonry. If you take your work, you bend yourself to the study of Masonry, you've discovered that there is a supreme or the most sublime form of charity. It helps to define it for us. It's not a meager handout separating the haves from the have-nots. Far from it. That is coming back to haunt the world in a wave of populism that we had thought was suppressed in the 40s and again and around the first part of the 20th century. It's populism and nationalism seem to be inextricably woven, and there are risks. And my goodness, Masonry is coming up again. We can calculate that Masonry will be caught in the headlights as populism strengthens and the voices of the wings of culture or society, as we say, try to define a line and the divisiveness between the us and them. This is everything from the clever wags that talk about if you're not with us, you're against us, or you know, you're not standing behind us, stand in front, you know, that kind of provocative rhetoric that's no longer boyish nonsense. And there's now consequence to that type of thing. And as much as you can ask men to think before they speak, and now enough of these groups around the world are feeding off each other once again. Now, is it too early to be alarmist? Well, you judge for yourself. Let history be your guide, brother. Again, the voice of a body of men not causing any concern for their community or their neighbors, But this dark matter performing acts of kindness and thoughtfulness, assisting their fellow man without bringing any attention to themselves. Now, any conspiracy theorists that are out there listening, don't get your shorts in a wad over this. This is simply helping in the neighbor, the same kind of people you have as neighbors when they need it. And they're the people that demonstrate what the need is, not a mason. And having that need met, you have to judge for yourself. If you think that that's dire and diabolical in some way, well, we don't share the same value system. If it's done sincerely, done genuinely, and it's absolutely well received, then I think it doesn't matter whether the recipient knows where it came from. Although it's nice, it came from a good person, a good man. And there are men in this world that can perform these acts of kindness without needing to grab headlines or be acknowledged. And in fact, they shy away from the headlines. It's not a place that it's not the benefit or reward, as so often happens in our modernized environments, that we lose track of the fact that there are a lot of people still exhibiting not old world values, but sincere values, sincere respect for their fellow man. And that's the majority, that's what carries us forward. That's the way that the majority of us interact every single day on countries all over the face of the earth, no matter what the zealots and the ridiculous might say about wanting to build a case, whether it's a tautological type of process, or it still remains that either we're looking for kindness and we'll find it. If you're looking for something more challenging and you're looking for friction, you have the intelligence to find that as well. The decision seems to be, what kind of a world do you think you want to live in, and what kind of world do you want to promote for our children and for our great grandchildren, for grandchildren? And at the end of the day, are we satisfied with our accomplishment? Hatred never seems to amount to much at the end of the day, just a lot of suffering. So, yeah, people are damaged and people hurt, but to suggest that gives there's some right to perpetuate wrongs on our fellow man is really curious, isn't it? So we live in a curious times, brethren, very, very curious times, where we can sit up and mindful, be aware. When the challenge comes to Masonry, will some of the members resign and to fit in with the clamor, the populist movements? Yes, absolutely, they did before, and they will again. I'm not suggesting for a moment that we'll see the kind of ruthless anti-Masonic flavor effort that has been done to the order. And if we give careful analysis, we begin to feel quite guilty or sheepish that perhaps a few incidents are blown out of proportion. Perhaps members were giving the impression that they were in charge, that somehow they had the collusion of this membership. Membership created collusions that all people couldn't access. We can say, well, that was wrong-minded and unintended and certainly un-Masonic. But we've also learned a valuable lesson around the world And we don't have to learn that lesson twice, do we? The lesson being the humility of Masonry is absolutely essential for our balanced outlook in life and for communities to feel safe and comfortable with us, you know, living amongst them. We are them. But more than a we and they, Freemasonry is about community and about wanting to make our community a better place to live. And we do that by harmonizing with other communities. And through our craft, we know that this kind, these ideas have flowed around the face of the globe. Now we have not a global village, but we have a global community. And we're adjusting, whole continents are adjusting to the values, the common values, the common laws, not one nation's laws, not one nation's politic, but the values and practices that we can all agree to uphold. And that's coming through dialogue. And it's so disturbing at times to witness the struggle to get there. While battles continue and disagreements bring people to a state of confrontation, always in the background are the diplomats. So always in the background are people putting out a hand to try and find a middle ground, to find that common purpose. And so whether we're in a state of favor or under a state of challenge, you and I remember the passion we felt for the values of being a Mason. This may be a big, settling. You know, the people that, if there are people that aren't clear and committed to the principles of Masonry, and haven't felt that they've been tested either in terms of their own conscience or their moral values, this may be a very useful step. Very useful step for all of us. I think the difficulty. Jeez. It's interesting that we have to reconcile, or we can reconcile the beauty of ritual and the that lovely warm feeling of being in a lodge with people that are familiar to us, that are respectful, everybody being respectful of the serenity of a Masonic lodge, striving to achieve that, striving in ways that are perhaps unusual for each person on an individual basis. But being in that environment is so heartwarming. It feels so wonderful, especially after when we're having a cup of coffee and glad handing with everybody. It's a very interesting time, an interesting experience that leaves a that does change a person's character, I think, in a very wonderful way. The dark matter of Masonry is much greater than what we see as visible. It's the goodwill. It's the unspoken. It's the beneficence. It's the idea of anticipating, assisting the young widow with her children, trying to make life a little happier and a little more pleasant for them, for no other reason than it makes us feel good. Although when a group of men get together, we have a capability of being quite mean-spirited, you know that, and severe. Generally, if you can put all of that aside, put that in the back of your mind. These are the same men that can learn, and often do, later in life, to reflect on who they, what their true nature is, and how they truly come across to other people. And in those moments, they begin to value their image in the minds of other people. And they have to sort out whether stepping on the stepping on people to get ahead has cost them anything, whether there's been a price for it. Always there's a price. Masonry is the world is going to need to lean on the values of Masonry for a while, more so than it has in the past century, gentlemen. We have a new we've opened up new channels of communication that are amazing, and that's brought new responsibilities. And so the as the world shudders and feels uncertain, the warmth and generosity that you bring to the discussion as men of character is going to be very important in ways that you will see and many ways that you will not. You will never know if the person that is pushing back and being grumpy with you or disagreeable doesn't go home and change their mind when they have a moment to reflect. You never know that. You're never going to be told that. And certainly, probably, no, those kind of fellows are never going to thank you. But goodwill, as we say, always prevails. Now, I'm going to start the tone of the program on the 22nd of January with a little with something that I that reminds me of the piety of a poet, an English poet that was born on this day in 1572. I'm speaking of none other than John Donne. He was a poet and a cleric in the Church of England. He was considered the preeminent representative of the metaphysical poets, beyond the physical. Eh? This is the fellow that said, "No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. Love built on beauty, soon as beauty dies." You sort of hear it? Judge a book by its cover. Consider what the important things are in life, what you need. Yeah. So we'll have some, I'll read some of John Donne's poetry today. And we're going to, I think, have a remarkable time as we usually do. Hope you like the show. Start off here with an interesting jazz pianist. This is a fellow that some of you may not have heard of, Gerald Clayton. He's was done in 2012, I think. Yeah. So and check it out and see what you think. This is out of New York City. Nice young man. Thank you. Get the idea. There's a little more. Maybe we'll play that at the end of the program. Makes you feel that Bill Evans is still alive, doesn't it? It also puts us in an interesting frame of mind. I want to thank the Lodge of Strict Observance for this kind of a feeling. One of the interesting experiences is going into the opening of a lodge and a piece of music has been selected. It's a lovely, lovely lodge in Toronto where they opened with you had the elective. You could go and sit in lodge and listen to Rachmaninoff. Oh, it was just, and so it was the people in the room that were really into that kind of a mindset. And if you've listened to Rachmaninoff, you have a sense of what I'm talking about. A sense of the drama and the passion. Talk about focus. Just seem to bring everything into clarity. And those that were visiting and chatting and catching up on business and what have you could wait outside until that portion of the evening was finished. Didn't take long, 6 minutes or so. But it was just a wonderful, thoughtful experience. Here today I'm talking to you about the lightness of being Masonic. That's you. No struggle can be greater than that within the consciousness of mankind. Striving to understand is not a proof of concept. Just being puzzled, that's no proof that we have conscious. Striving means defining a process that is affected by free radicals. Striving. The free radicals are all of the unwanted, unexpected influences that shape an outcome. I'm not talking here about the boyish state of just wanting things when you want them, being very demanding, and compelling other people to do your bidding. That is a bit... We won't talk about that here. The free radicals, everything that's been calculated, and then something happens. Well, what that person hasn't done is calculated in the randomness of existence. They haven't paid careful attention to the Buddha. Oh, let's separate out our math from our philosophy. Until these darn metaphysicians get to us. Let's separate all of that out. But there are underlying moments. The randomness around us is interesting because it creates a need. Our mind has a capacity. This defines a capacity, this randomness. Our brains like consistency, and they like patterns. The brain likes patterns. We need to be able to separate out what's going on with our brain from our personality, the choices that we make with it. This is just what brains do. And brains would rather follow a pattern because it takes less energy to do that than trying to make calculations. Every time you have to calculate what you need to do, it takes a little bit more energy, a little bit more time. And it requires a greater coordination within the brain of different areas of the brain. Patterns are like autopilot in a way. There's just too many of them for me to consider that clumsy, but we like patterns. And our brain will figure out patterns even when, you know, the calculation isn't there. The data isn't there. The math isn't quite there. The beauty of that organ that sits on top of us and controls everything else. The balance between knowledge and imagination is an unbroken middle earth of forces. Unbroken. Unbroken because the geometry teaches us one without the other is unsatisfying. How do we measure the progress of Masonic values? Since the Masonic epoch, history and culture have evolved. Stating the obvious deal. There wasn't a defining moment, no single event, but a process of interacting ideas and events is where we track the genesis of Masonry. Philosophy integrated with science and the arts. It became, if such a thing can exist, a theological hybrid. It can be argued, or our early architecture needed constitutional protection against a hostile, violent world. It became resilient. Whether we acknowledge the science or not, those processes remain in view. That's the lightness of Masonry, brethren. When we accept that these processes, the same processes that forged the values and the ideas of Masonry, the same processes are at play around us every single day. Are we distracted? Probably. Do we look for those processes? Well, it's important to be able to understand what the processes were and what they've done to help us to appreciate where to look for them. And I'm afraid it can be as something as simplistically complicated as a drop of dew on a flower petal. So the new geometry, we've gone beyond Euclidean geometry, the new geometry that helps us to make calculations about the shape of clouds and waves and everything in the universe. There's a point to it. There's a sense to it. There are patterns. If we know where to look and what to look for, we start to observe. So open our minds. That's the lightness once we understand this. Once we understand these things and this struggle subsides, that battle with the unexpected becomes sort of a meaningless statement. There's no battle. The unexpected happens. Accept that. And the unwanted may be part of that. Those are all our value judgments. Do we want certain things to happen? Well, I never want bad things to happen to people that I like, and by extension, I don't want bad things to happen to anybody. But do I go around carrying that burden in my mind 24 hours a day? No. No. Sometimes it's easy to push that aside to be able to focus on where I'm driving or what I need to do or my next meeting or conversation or decisions that have to be made. It's never too far away. And gratefully, Masonry allows me to express that unworded shift. What do I do about something that's really important, but I can't sustain it in my mind, in the front center of my mind 24 hours a day? Well, I can roll up my sleeves and do something concrete. It's not an answer to the metaphysical dilemma, but it's better than nothing, and it's not bad, especially if it helps. It makes a difference in people's lives, and that's a good thing. That's a Masonic thing. I'm reminded of some, when I'm talking about these elements and forces that are at play around us, I'm reminded of some things that are, things that were happening when the forms of Grand Lodge, English Grand Lodge of London in 1717, was occurring. And it didn't occur in 1717. It was built. That's 300 years ago, folks. I've been thinking about, in my mind, the celebrations that we could have to recognize this state. But I'm more of a dreamer than some, I think. Thank goodness we have practical people that will are thinking about what needs to be done day by day. I'm grateful for everything that they do. But the world I live in is a better place because there's dreamers, people with imagination. So here, check this out. This is from material by Margaret C. Jacob. And yes, think about the scholarship involved in this and how this scholar is doing things for Masonry that Masons can't do for themselves. This is from one of her books called Living the Enlightenment. Oh, and if we're getting into discussions of the Reformation and Counter-Reformation and Enlightenment, Renaissance, let's not lose track of the fact that there was a lot of damage done and, everything comes at a price. But I digress. I hope you're enjoying the program. It's moving on, whether you're in morning or afternoon or evening, and sitting down with a glass of your favorite libation, and the room's quiet. You can have an uninterrupted conversation with me and yell at me and disagree and carry on the thought. I'll always carry on the thought, and I'll listen. I'll be in the room with you, and I'll listen. there's a little something to thank you for arriving and being part of this Masonic Effects today. This is called Tenderly. It's recorded at 1951 in Birdland. It's Miles Davis. Yeah. There's Sahib. Sahib is on baritone sax and Wade Legge on piano. Check it out.
How about something real quiet and pretty, Miles, right now? Something like the very beautiful standard Tenderly. Thank you.
So it's like, no, that's a long, he was quite young then. Me, I'm more inclined to Chet Baker or even Clifford Brown's version of Tenderly, but judge yourself accordingly. Judge yourself accordingly. Sit back, gentlemen, and give me your opinion about this. After the founding of Grand Lodge in London in 1717, are we okay? Are you okay to talk about this? Hundreds of lodges sprang up there and in the provinces. As in the case of Dundee Lodge, some had evolved out of local guilds and in their early practices mixed to gentlemen, merchants, and workers of various crafts and practicing masons. But increasingly, most lodges were totally speculative. That is, no members were operative practicing masons. The distinction was noted throughout the century by Masonic orators and commented upon favorably. Masonry is now advanced to a far higher degree of perfection than it could boast upon its first institution, a Masonic preacher of 1777, speaking in the Anglican Church at Colchester, informed his fellow lodge members. Formerly, it was only operative, confined to manual labor, and studied only the improvement of art. Gradually, however, workers were displaced from the lodges as morals, learnings, and religion advanced in the world. So masonry then became speculative. Now, for me, I find that a remarkable little tell right there. As morals, learning, and religion advanced in the world, so masonry then became speculative and attended to the cultivation of the mind. So what this is saying to me is that the people that labored used their hands, and that those that thought used their minds. Separate groups. In fact, I don't know that to be true. With this attentiveness came an earnest desire to promote the good and happiness of our fellow creatures. Once entirely divorced from its practical and manual functions, and in most lodges from workers themselves, the British Masonic imagination took flight. Maybe they were tuning into Masonic effects. It became not just speculative, but frequently utopian. Where have we dealt with that before, gentlemen? Well, the last couple of weeks. Rather than approach this world of private sociability through a single lodge, the writer chose instead to survey the extensive published literature produced by the many lodges, which in 1740 numbered 180. The sermons and orations were first preached before the assembled brothers, who in turn deemed them worthy of publication. Public, huh? Whether published or unpublished, Masonic orations expressed the highest ideals of this private society, and throughout this book, the author relied heavily upon them. When combined with other types of Masonic publications, they can tell us a great deal about the ideals of this new form of sociability as they were then being developed, not by guildsmen, but by gentlemen, merchants, professional men, the literate and reasonably affluent who flocked to the new lodges. I think one of the aspects that we can safely recognize is that masonry requires an element of literacy. Now, this use of literate isn't that a person can read and write. It alludes to the fact that a person reads, not that they can read, that they read. And that, at the time, would be the classics. and they would be studying Greek history and Roman history, and they would be learning Latin because that was what was done in the day. Already a lost language. But Latin, the study of Latin, teaches us a way of thinking, doesn't it? These men were participants in what British historians have now come to see as leisure revolution. That brought with it in the 18th century revitalized towns, unprecedented luxury, and an elite culture based upon affluence and luxury. All of that is reflected and indeed glorified in Masonic literature. In its essential optimism, Masonic literature is utopian. It looks to the secular and social order for perfectibility. But in so looking, it exhibits a distinctly practical attitude. Although concerned with the coherence and rationality of the ideal society, British Masonic utopian literature imagines that such an order is in some sense possible. Historians who have looked at enlightened utopias have tended recently to discount their worldliness, their actual interest in the incarnation of their dreams. Such a dismissal does not work for the British Masonic and utopian impulse. Rightly or wrongly, brothers believed that they had taken one important step toward the perfectibility of the human order within their own lodges. Benighted, we might say, but not irrelevant. The European political order would be transformed by the revolutions late in the century. We should listen to the dreamers across the channel first and then see if what they were saying bears any relation to the course of the European political development in the late 18th century. This is not suggesting that continental Freemasons simply borrowed the language of their English brothers. Rather, lodges in both places were spaces in a new zone of civil society within aspects of the larger political and social order mirrored and mimicked. Also yet and simultaneously open to scrutiny and criticism. Open to scrutiny and criticism. No sacred cows inside a Masonic lodge. Everything's in play. So this isn't something that we can run away, that we can't hide and we can't erase. It is an integral element of Masonry. It's the accountability. If we're not talking it out loud, then we're talking in the shadows. But we're always talking. But utopia? Oh. Where do we go with this? Thomas More, where are you when we need you? Predictably, British utopians were at moments troubled. In the British context, the century of government by oligarchy, their utopianism came in tandem with an underlying concern for decadence and corruption. One seemed to come with the other, eh? The 18th century cast up many versions of the ancient regime, many forms of social privilege and exclusive access to political power, besides those we associate with absolutism on the continent. Concern about corruption and the tyranny associated with it expressed itself in Britain through the politics and philosophy of government known as the country opposition. Juxtaposed against the largely Whig oligarchy, the court, which controlled the offices of government, opposition sentiment could turn up in the politics of either party, Whigs or Tories. But interestingly, after the Hanoverian succession in 1714, the rhetoric of the country belonged to segments of the Tory party. The ideological roots of the country lie, however, not in the Toryism of the late 17th century, but in the republicanism of the mid-English Revolution, mid-century. The point about the country was not its political affiliations, which could shift, but rather, given its origins, its potential radicalism. Increasingly, the view from the country claimed to represent lesser men, not the great landed gentry, not their placement in the sinews of government employment. It became the voice of small merchants, shopkeepers, and even artisans. They openly attacked what they described as the corruption of oligarchic ministers who had become, by appropriation, the actual heirs of the liberties and privileges believed to be confirmed by the revolution settlement, by the defeat of absolutism and arbitrary government in 1689. In the 1690s, this country opposition percolated on the fringes of the Whig Party. Its most representative exponents, politicians and free thinkers like John Tolan and Anthony Collins, saw themselves as the heirs of the Commonwealth tradition, of the mid-century republicanism of James Harrington or John Milton. By the 1760s, the country opposition had come to mean angry crowds and tumultuous assemblies in support of the radical parliamentarian John Wilkes. Once again, radicalism surfaced in British politics, and although its public face was Whig, some of its proponents could once have been country Tories. The tensions between court and country is one of the central motifs of 18th century British politics. From its very inception at the beginning of the Grand Lodge of London, Freemasons expressed the ideological tension between court and country. Its literature, sermons, and orations are permeated with it. In Masonic thought, the desire to emulate the luxury and order associated with court and oligarchy expressed itself concurrently with the fear that luxury bred corruption. In general, published British Masonic rhetoric had a distinctive court air about it. It identified with oligarchy and monarchy as bound by the Constitution and the Revolution Settlement. When the discussion turned to corruption, it was being held among the relatively affluent who are drawn to and glory in the pleasures and privileges derived from stable government, yet who are also troubled by the consequences. This is also a private discussion, where in contrast to its public counterpart, other values more enlightened than traditional could be affirmed within the lodges. In addition, it must not be forgotten that some Masonic lodges had the air of the Jacobite hanging about them. But nostalgia for the exiled Stuarts could easily be seen as treasonable in Britain, not the sort of thing that lodges would see into print. Not that it wasn't there, they didn't print it. Although British Jacobites made their mark in continental lodges, there is no published Masonic literature in English that is Jacobite. How does court and country fit with your thinking of the evolution of Masonry? Does your experience match that of Professor Jacob's observations? It's hard to reconcile the evidence and that she cites. All she's doing and all we're doing is trying to make sense of it, knowing that part of our Constitution, part of our values as Masons, includes this accountability through criticism. But the strain is perhaps that how to sort of what is subjective, what is objective, and over time reconcile our current experience with what's happening around us day by day. Here, we're wrapping up the show for today. It's been a pleasure. Sometimes we need to inject, I think, and I hope you agree, some recorded history. History of masonry that helps us to understand what shaped the ideas that we're experiencing in masonry today. Especially today, I'm reminded that court and country, that balance is being played out in other nations of the world even today, and here in Canada to a lesser extent. Lesser pronounced, but to an equally great extent. Where privilege and affluence is, there comes the suspicion of corruption. And can those that are enjoying the privilege of rank be seen as speaking for our country, for the disadvantaged, the people that are disadvantaged? We have less tolerance for the disadvantaged today than in this period of British history. We have less tolerance, but the tools to do something about it have been handled, in a sense, according to Ms. Jacobs, by the powerful and affluent. I have nothing more to say on that today. I hope you do. If you do, be sure to stay in touch with us through MasonicEffects@gmail.com. It's been a pleasure having you join us today. Thanks very much. I'll see you soon. We're skipping next week. Yes, we're going to be down in Los Angeles for a little business. So when we come back, I'll have much to say, and I hope that you'll be here. This is Nora Jones.
Turn me on.